Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Sons of Kolchak. A company commander during the Vietnam Tet Offensive of 1968 tells the story of his men's raw courage and valor. By Michael E. Wicken, Lieutenant Colonel, U.S. Army, retired. Narrated by Sean Compton. Foreword. The Westmoreland Letter. The story you are about to read was first written with a pencil upon legal-size yellow paper in 1988. Over the next year, it was converted to word processor, and a couple years after that, to Microsoft Word. In 1994, the draft was accepted by a publisher for commercial publication and distribution. In 1995, I attended a cocktail party for General and Mrs. William C. Westmoreland, and as we spoke, I told him about the book contract. He graciously agreed to look at the story and perhaps write an introduction. Several months later, he returned to our home and spent a morning at my house drinking coffee and discussing the book and several of the incidents covered in the manuscript. I was flattered by his attention since the last time I saw him, prior to the cocktail party, was in 1968. By late 1996, we had his introduction pared down to a final draft, which would change one word. This draft, with his handwritten note, is what follows. The publisher, meantime, filed for bankruptcy shortly after General Westmoreland was preparing his final letter, and 5 years later, the rights to my story, Sons of Kolchak, were returned to me by the Utah Bankruptcy Court. I never pursued publication after that time, until now. Finally, the story that General Westmoreland agreed to introduce so long ago is ready. Introduction. Sons of Kolchak. Through the Vietnam War and the United States' direct involvement in Vietnam ended more than 20 years ago, books about the protracted conflict will be written for years to come. My personal direct involvement as COM USMAC V ended 28 years ago when I was reassigned to the position of Chief of Staff of the U.S. Army. Yet, in the minds of more than a million soldiers who served in Vietnam, and many more millions of our citizens, I shall forever be linked to the specific time period covered in Sons of Kolchak, a story of the Tet Offensive of 1968. In my book, A Soldier Reports, written following my 36 years of active duty service, I wrote in great detail about the Tet time period, the political interaction that I had to deal with as a day-to-day reality, and how the press reports and media coverages of events served to change the focus of our nation from the facts of military success and opportunity to internal conflict. The 5 months that followed, the North Vietnamese Army changing the war from what had been primarily a guerrilla war to a conventional conflict, presented our Allied forces with unprecedented tactical successes throughout South Vietnam. It is time that the battalion and company commanders of the time period present their stories, and, in so doing, help fill the picture and truth of combat service in Vietnam. Lieutenant Colonel Mike Wicken has presented a vivid and credible picture of life in an infantry company and participation in significant combat engagements. I well remember the night combat assault Mike and his company conducted the night of 29 to 30 January 1968. The action was of enough significance that his battalion commander, Lieutenant Colonel Walter Adams, briefed the action to commanders throughout Vietnam that lessons learned could be applied elsewhere. Sons of Kolchak is a well-told story, and unusual in its presentation of the parallel stories of what the enemy was doing at the time. War is not a pretty business, and there is much unvarnished conflict presented in this book with the attendant courage, valor, and heroism which characterized our soldiers in Vietnam. But it is the humor and leadership challenges presented in this story which gives this credibility beyond just being a battle after-action report. The time of Tet 1968 and the period before were primarily small unit actions, platoon and company, interspersed occasionally with larger scale operations. The actions of commanders, leaders, and men within these small units was generally excellent. When I was first contacted by the author of Sons of Kolchak, I could not quite place him in my memory, though I remembered the presentation of the Distinguished Service Cross ceremony to one of Mike's soldiers in the Iron Triangle. In March 1996, we met at a party, and then at Mike's home in Florida, and talked about his book and the time when I was superintendent of the United States Military Academy. Mike was a member of the class of 1964, which entered the academy in 1960. Shortly before the end of the summer, the class voted on its class motto, and I submitted "Give It More 64" as one of the nominated mottos. In a close vote, the class chose instead the motto, "Stars in Store for 64. At that time, neither they nor I knew that the stars that were in store would primarily refer to the silver and bronze stars won on the field of battle. Now, as the class of 64 nears the end of its military service to our nation, it counts 15 that reached the stars of general, including one four-star general, and men who shaped the education of our nation's future leaders as Commandant of the Army War College and Dean of Academics at West Point. I believe that readers will find this story of interest and will remember that it was written by a man awarded 2 silver stars for valor and whose division commander once characterized him as fearless and absolutely cool under pressure. W.C. Westmoreland, General, U.S. Army, retired. Prologue. Kolchak was a Russian wolfhound. The wolfhound is the only animal fearless and ferocious enough to consistently hunt and kill wolves. Sometimes, though, in the hunt and ensuing fight, the wolf wins. This does not deter the wolfhound, however, and the most enduring characteristic of this animal is what men call fearlessness. Men have always admired such animals and have used their characteristics to pay honor to men of great courage, skill, or position. To be said to have the eyes of an eagle, or strength of a bear, or to have the regal carriage of a lion, brings an inner glow of satisfaction to men so characterized. The U.S. Army's 27th Infantry Regiment was characterized as being fearless as wolfhounds while serving in Siberia in 1918. The regiment was given Kolchak as a mascot when they departed their mission with the White Russians against the Bolshevik and Cossack belligerents in 1920. The regiment adopted the nickname of Wolfhounds. Though the Army reorganizes from time to time, lineage to a parent regiment is maintained by battalions. Today there are brigades instead of regiments. Before brigades, there were battle groups. There are a few regiments which remain in the Army's organization as armored cavalry regiments, but very few. The 27th Infantry Regiment no longer exists except as battle flags and trophies packed in boxes awaiting a time when our country may once again need units to bear the regimental lineage. During our country's involvement in the Vietnam War, 2 battalions carried the lineage of the Wolfhounds, the 1st and 2nd battalions of the 27th Infantry Regiment. Both battalions were assigned to the 25th Infantry Division and maintained their permanent base camp at Cu Chi, some 25 miles to the northwest of Saigon. In late 1988, I was contacted by a writer of military history. He had learned that I was involved in certain battles that he was researching for a book about the Tet Offensive of 1968. He was looking for some highly detailed, first-hand accounts of that time period and asked if I could provide him information. I responded that I indeed had some information that he might find of use. However, I thought the story might be too long to include in his book. Then I set out to see if I could recover the data which would help me tell an accurate story, not just a story shadowed by the passage of time and colored by faulty memories. I did not keep a journal of my time in Vietnam, but I was able to recover 3 sets of data that let me trace the locations and events described in this book. My wife and my parents kept the letters I wrote them from Vietnam. The letters written to my wife were some of the most boring letters ever written to anyone. In trying to shield her from actual events, I think I overdid the job. But those letters gave me 2 important things: locations and dates. The letters written to my father contained the details of what occurred. I had the need to recount what was happening from time to time, and I used my father, an army officer himself, as the man entrusted to be told what I was doing. The 3rd data source was the very few battle after action reports and papers that I kept and just never threw away. The task that I thought could be completed in 30 or 40 pages took almost 10 times that to complete. By the time I had written 20 pages, I realized that to tell the real story, I would have to take the time to tell nearly the whole story. The story is, of course, a very personal one, as seen from my eyes and the memory of my experience. But this is more than just my story. For this story includes the elements which make the experiences of the 2nd Wolfhound Battalion truly unique. It is the telling of meeting and re-meeting the same enemy units that makes this more than just a memoir. It is truly a story of conflict and revenge. Instead of using actual names of people, commanders, leaders, sergeants, and soldiers, I chose to use instead their call signs for the positions they occupied. I did this for three reasons. First, because it is the events and actions of this story that are most important. Second, because I just could not remember the names of many of the people whose actions I have described. And third, and most important, because I did not want to give undue weight of importance only to the men whose names I remembered. For those who are not familiar with call sign convention, I have tried to link the call sign with the position occupied at logical places in the story. It is interesting to note that in the Army today, call signs and frequencies assigned for radio communication are changed several times daily. 50 years ago, that was not true, and our units maintained the same frequencies and people maintained the same call signs for the entire time they held a particular job position. Therein lies one of the elements of this story, for it explains how the enemy hunted us, even as we hunted them. The enemy we faced was far more sophisticated in their intelligence capabilities than we generally supposed. I have included four names only. The first is that of Captain Leroy Pitts. Leroy was the man who preceded me as commander of Charlie Company. Leroy's name is there to preserve the point of historical interest that his final actions in this life produced. Captain Leroy Pitts was the first black officer to be awarded the Medal of Honor. I have tried to tell of his actions what the men who were around him when he died told me. The second name I have preserved is that of General Westmoreland, just because it made better sense than calling him the MACV commander. The third and fourth names are those of two Vietnamese, Sin and Siem, because their role was constant and clearly identified, and this allowed me to differentiate their actions from those of the rest of my soldiers. Both were made honorary Wolfhounds, and both were a credit to our unit. At the end of a man's tour with the Wolfhounds, he was accorded the honor of being a son of Kolchak, the king of all Wolfhounds. The departing soldier was given a parchment scroll attesting to his status as a true Wolfhound. The scroll given in Vietnam reads, "Omnipotent Order of Kolchak, King of all Wolfhounds. To all true pups, wherever ye may be, greetings. Know ye that from the hazardous environs of Kuchi, through the Michelin gauntlet and up the Boiloy corridor, has come a staunch and true bearer of the crest, who has washed the paddies of Zam Moy with the sweat of righteous terror, and has, through arduous practice, developed the artillery flinch to the satisfaction of his superiors. Be it further known that since the gallant challenger of Hanoi and the Viet Cong has looked unblinkingly into the tunnel mouths of the enemy, known the ecstasy of being selected as a sniper's target, has been duly initiated into the association of the ambushed, and accepted into intimacy by the virtuous sisters, heat, humidity, and monsoon, christened with the revered drippings of non-potable ice and baptized in Saigon tea. Be it therefore proclaimed that, name, has been found worthy to be admitted to the omnipotent order of Kolchak as a regal barker. Be it therefore ordered that all Wolfhound warriors accord, name, with all honor and respect to which he is entitled. Given under the paw and seal of Kolchak V. The scroll is signed by the Wolfhound commander, countersigned by Ye Wolfhound, and marked by the paw of Kolchak V, king of all Wolfhounds. The scroll is decorated with the battalion's crest, the head of a Wolfhound, and the Latin motto, Nec aspera terrent, which means fearless. For those of you who are history buffs, take note of the story of the first battle of the Tet Offensive, the truth of the Tan Son Nhut textile factory, and baiting attempt near Cambodia. The parallel stories of the two enemy regiments are only as true as I can tell them. Their movements are as I remember them, and the Tet Offensive missions are true. The enemy conversations are, of course, contrived by me, but they reflect the things that I have imagined about those men for more than 20 years. The parallel story of the young enemy soldier is true. Here and there I may have missed a day in the story of the wolfhounds, or may have misplaced an event or two. If so, these are wholly unintentional. The conversations recorded really happened and have been related the best that my memory permits. For me, the walk back in time to the days of 1967 and 1968 has been personally rewarding and illuminating. So come, let me show you where the sons of Kolchak walked while I tell the story of high adventure and danger, so that you might know the joy and sadness, heroism and duty, of what it was to be a wolfhound. I only hope that I have told the story well enough. Departing. The helicopter's engine began its whine, and the rotor blades began to turn as I threw my bag aboard and climbed in. The noise of the engine and speed of the rotors increased as I buckled the safety belt around my waist and put on the communications headset. The pilot looked over his shoulder at me, and his voice was clear over the headphones as he asked, "Are you ready to go, Mike?" "Yeah, sure, let's get out of here," I answered. We rose to a hover and turned toward the center of the runway. Looking through the dust raised by the prop wash, I saw our division commander standing by the jeep that had brought us to the airfield. I first sat tall in my seat, then leaned forward to make sure that he saw my farewell salute. He returned my salute, and I waved a last goodbye as the general's command and control ship changed pitch, gathered speed, and then rose as we departed Cu Chi, Vietnam. It was the 5th of July, 1968, and I was going home. The helicopter continued its rise west, and I could see first the battalion headquarters, and then the company, my company, hooches and barracks where so much of my time had been spent. We continued to rise, and the voice in my ears said, "Thought I'd give you one last look at the area of operations, the AO. My response was automatic as I pushed the switch to talk. "Yeah, okay. Sure is hazy today." I looked toward the northwest, and a kaleidoscope of images and memories came tumbling through my mind. There, the Boiloi Woods, where we first met the 271st Regiment, and they took my platoon. And beyond in the mist, Zamrang with its marksmen, and Nui Ba Den, the Black Virgin Mountain, marking the turning point to Cambodia, where we tried to bait the enemy from his sanctuary. Where my eyes could not see, my mind replaced the mist with images of startling clarity. The helicopter continued its ascent and slowly began to arc north, around our division base camp. Here, the Hobo Woods, where we spent Christmas, and Santa Claus came to visit. There, by the bend in the river, the VC Hotel. West of there was the Tiger's Lair. And beyond, the battlefield that marked the place where Tet began, and Charlie Company began its climb to greatness. Way beyond, War Zone D with its dark, silent jungles and the Great Python. And closer, the Iron Triangle and its labyrinth of tunnels. The helicopter stopped its climb and swung toward the south. Now my eyes marked the places of the Goman Battalion disaster and the Hakmon Swamp where Leroy Pitts won his Medal of Honor against the Goman, and where Charlie Company took its final retribution against the 271st. "Have you seen enough?" "Yeah, let's go. Let's get to Saigon." "Ha, you've got plenty of time. The Freedom Bird doesn't leave for 4 or 5 hours yet. The old man really wanted you to stay, you know." "Yep, but I've been taught you don't volunteer for nothing." "But are you sorry to be going?" "Hell no, are you kidding me? Now let's get out of here." "Well, I'm going to give you a ride you won't forget. Hold on." And the helicopter began its drop, the way a hawk folds its wings and stoops for a kill. Down, rushing down, we headed for the Hakmon Swamp until we were skimming barely over the tall grasses. As my eyes marked the spot so familiar to me, my mind surrendered to the images that rushed and collided in a montage of remembering and forgetting. There, the ambush spot. The canal bank where the 271st left their dead piled like wood for the winter. Ha! The home of the perfect pig. And there, the buffalo wallow. Oh yes, that's where we took our revenge. Wonder if the old woman who warned us of the booby traps still lives in that place. And to the east. Yes, there it was. The place where the ambush failed. The aircraft skipped over the hedgerows and hamlets and rushed at top speed over the rice paddies, sending water buffalo stampeding and farmers turning to watch our hasty passage. Then we rose, nearing Saigon, and proceeded at a more rational speed. You know the general would be damn mad if he knew you were flying his bird this way. Ah, well, he's not here. See any familiar territory? I saw a few spots I thought were familiar. There, coming up now, the textile factory, and where the three-quarter calves stopped the Tonson Nut attack, and the police headquarters we took back, and the South Vietnamese compound the NVA forgot. The helicopter made its approach and descended to the helipad designated Hotel 3. Take care, Mike. You too, and thanks for the ride. Anytime. Sure you're not going to miss this place? Hell no. I'm not leaving anything behind but dead soldiers and bad memories. Bye, and thanks again for the ride. I took my bag and walked the short walk to Camp Alpha. It was time to out-process. Time to go home. A few hours later, it was wheels up as our freedom bird began its steep ascent to the east to avoid any possibility of ground fire. The passengers gave a loud cheer and began to clap. I closed my eyes through the climb, and my mind resurrected the visions of battlefields and firefights, and mostly the men of Charlie Company, my men. There had been so many. We had been so close. And already I was forgetting their names. But the faces, the images, were still sharp and clear, even though I had left them more than 4 months earlier. I wondered if they remembered me. They were on their third commander since my departure. I wondered if they knew just how good they were. The plane had leveled, and the pilot announced the flight plan information and then mentioned that the stewardesses would be serving drinks, if anyone were interested. There was another loud cheer from our passengers at this announcement. I opened my eyes and looked out the window. Already Vietnam was receding in the mist of distance. Already we were over the ocean, and I could see the dark specks which marked the picket line of Navy ships off the coast. Had it really been a year? Remember the entry to Vietnam by ship? Remember Da Nang and your first view of the war? The Phantom that crashed? And the artillery booming, then exploding against the mountains to the west, and the sampan shot by the patrol boat, and the secondary explosions. Remember the trip down the coast, watching those picket ships firing their guns against the beaches and hills. Remember the 42 officers and 2,500 men that came with you as mass replacements for the 25th Division? How many of them made it? Some should be going home today, too. Are any on this plane? I ordered a bourbon and coke, and introducing myself to the captain beside me broke my reverie for a while. We talked and drank, and then he said he was planning to sleep most of the trip and closed his eyes. I stepped over his legs and walked back to the galley where several other soldiers were already getting another drink. I was wide awake and welcomed company. Hi there, Captain. Glad to see you made it. Well, hello. Haven't seen you in a year. Glad you made it, too. Are there others here that came over with us? Damn right. I think most of the plane is filled with our guys. Hello, Charlie Six. Damn, I'd forgotten that you came over with us, too. How's the company? Well, it's all right, but it's on its third commander since you left. The first two were relieved, but the latest one, he might turn out to be a good Charlie Six. Damn, we lost a lot of men after you left. Is Top still there? Damn right, he extended, you know. Thought you'd extend, too. Heard you had a cushy job as an aide. Hey, remember when Top played Santa Claus? We both laughed at the memory and talked some more. And the memories, the images, kept rushing back as we talked. Others came to the galley, and finally we left to return to our seats and make room for the new arrivals. As I walked back to my seat, I looked at the other passengers, and here and there I saw familiar faces, and some recognized me, too. I climbed back into my seat and fastened the safety belt, watching the ocean and clouds while I finished my drink. Then I sat back and closed my eyes, thinking that I, too, might sleep. But my thoughts kept me awake, and finally I let them wander, taking me back to Charlie Company and how it all began. Zomrang. Damn, damn, damn. Here I was in the middle of a firefight, and I had only landed to join Delta Company 5 minutes ago. If I had just kept my big mouth shut, I'd still be orbiting with our battalion commander and operations officer 1,500 feet overhead, bored but safe. But no, I had argued that I needed to be on the ground with the companies if I was going to ever develop any current intelligence and not just parrot week-old rumors and reports from daily int sums, intelligence summaries. If I had just been straightforward with our new battalion commander, Trojan 6, I wouldn't be here now. I had told him that I wanted a rifle company, but he was new to the battalion and didn't want to change the organization. I hadn't told him that I really resented being treated as no more than a radio operator for Trojan 3, our operations officer. I hadn't told him that I felt I was being prevented from doing the job to which I was assigned. I hadn't told him how much I resented him giving Alpha Company to a newly assigned captain. Damn it, I hadn't told him just how badly I wanted a command. Minutes before, two platoons from Delta Company and one platoon from Alpha Company had begun crossing an area of rice paddies to enter the hamlet of Zomrang. Delta 6, the Delta Company commander, and his command group were trailing the two Delta platoons on the right, and I trailed behind the Alpha platoon leader on the left flank. The platoons, moving into the chest-high meadow of green rice stalks, spread like dark green fence posts against the bright green of the rice. 20 yards into the rice paddies, the platoon leaders with their radio operators separated from the hedgerow line and followed their troops. And 30 yards later, I saw Delta 6 step into the waving fields, followed by his radio operators, artillery observer, medic, and interpreter. I watched and studied the dark green line of bamboo, which marked Zomrang. At that range, the play of light and shadow blurred any detail. Involuntarily, I shuddered and watched our troops move and knew absolutely what great targets they made and how definitely their formation marked their leaders. One man who could shoot would have his choice of targets once the unit moved closer. And I decided to stay next to the hedgerow, hidden by the shadows until the platoons reached the hamlet. Delta 6 was also measuring the distances and the hedgerow to our front. He first halted his right flank platoon after they had moved 50 yards. Then, another 50 yards along, he halted his second platoon and moved up the one that had been halted. The Alpha platoon continued forward until the midpoint to the objective had been reached, then crossed. The sharp report of a single rifle shot dropped the Alpha platoon leader. The troops dropped into the rice paddy, and the lieutenant began calling for a medic, who I saw running to assist him. There was no answering hail of return fire, since no one knew where the shot had come from. Another round came seeking a target and missed, and the soldiers returned fire at a still unlocated target. I ran into the rice to help the medic, under the covering fire of the Delta and Alpha rifles. Two enemy rifles shot, dropping another Alpha platoon leader, and the Alpha medic now had a problem. Two wounded men and no way to get them out. The lieutenant had been hit hard, in his left leg close to his groin, and an artery had been severed. We had to get this man out fast, and there was no way to carry him back under the guns of the enemy. I sent the medic on and told him I'd take care of the lieutenant. Grabbing the back of the platoon leader's fatigue jacket and harness from his web gear, I began pulling him back toward the hedgerow from which I had come. I yelled at him to kick with his right leg and keep his hands on the pressure bandage the medic had applied. We left a trail of blood in the muddy rice paddy water, and I was afraid he'd bleed to death. I pulled and cursed him to make him mad and keep him conscious. I cursed him for his size and reminded him that I'd told him he was too big to be an infantryman months earlier. And I cursed him for keeping...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?